A man in grimy coveralls stepped up to him and pushed the muzzle of a 9mm automatic into Quintana's midsection. "Antichrist!" he snarled. And he emptied the gun's magazine into Quintana's midriff and chest, smashing him back against the dispatcher's booth. The shots rang deafeningly through the garage. Quintana felt no pain, but the world seemed to tilt into a crazy lopsided scene of concrete ceiling and staring faces. The man with the gun stood calmly over him. "Let's see your devil's bugs cure you of that!" And he spat on Quintana's shattered, bleeding body. Moonbase Director's Office. "This nanotech treaty has got to be stopped," Joanna said. Greg nodded tightly. He had been director of Moonbase for slightly more than 6 months. What had been Ginny Anson's office was now his, and he had transformed it considerably. His desk was an ultra-modern curved surface of gleaming lunar glass steel, a new alloy from Moonbase's labs that was as transparent as crystal, yet had the structural strength of high-grade concrete. A long couch of lunar plastic sat against one wall, and comfortable webbed chairs were scattered across the floor, which was covered with soft, sound-absorbing tiles manufactured in one of Masterson Corporation's space station factories in orbit around Earth. The air in the room was pleasantly cool, like an air-conditioned office of a major corporation back on Earth. Greg had insisted on paving a large section of Alphonsus's floor with new radiators that allowed the environmental control system to work more efficiently and made all of Moonbase's underground facilities much more comfortable. It was his major accomplishment to date. The office walls were lined with precisely spaced window wall display screens. Most of them showed artwork from the world's great museums, although Greg could, at the touch of a keypad, turn them into views of virtually any part of Moonbase or the surface of Alphonsus's crater floor. Behind Greg was a giant window wall that presently showed a restful silk scroll landscape of mountains and mist by the 13th century Chinese master Cao Kogong. It lent the office an air of serenity that neither Joanna nor her two sons felt. "Will the United States sign the treaty?" Doug asked from his seat on the couch against the far wall. Joanna, sitting on the webbed chair closest to Greg's curved desk, had noticed that Doug always picked that couch to sit on. It was farthest from his brother. "Yes, of course they will," Greg said, frowning darkly. "The whole idea of the treaty came from Washington."
"But they can't outlaw nanotechnology completely," Joanna said. "Not entirely."
"Yes, they can," said Doug. Joanna knew he was just as concerned as his older brother, yet Doug looked at ease, relaxed, lounging back on the long couch as if this were nothing more than a computer game. She almost expected him to put his feet up and stretch out for a nap. "But if they do, they'll want us to stop using nanomachines here at Moonbase, too. We can't allow that." Greg shook his head. "If and when the U.S. signs the treaty, its provisions will be like federal law, and we'll be bound by them, just like any flatlander down Earthside."
"You'll have to stop work on the mass driver," Joanna said.
With a tight nod, Greg said, "We'll have to stop everything that we use nanomachines for."
"That means closing Moonbase," she said.
Greg started to nod, but Doug interrupted with, "As long as we remain an American corporation."
"I've thought about that," Joanna said. "But Venezuela, Ecuador, all the European nations, they're all going to sign the treaty."
"What about Kiribati?"
Greg looked sharply at his brother.
"Kiribati?
Don't you have enough clout with them to keep them from signing, Greg?" Doug asked.
"What good would that do?" Greg almost growled the words.
Joanna turned to her elder son hopefully.
"We could transfer our articles of incorporation to Kiribati."
Greg shook his head dismissively. "And get half a dozen federal agencies jumping all over us. They'd take us to court, and the courts would decide against us. We'd be in real trouble. They'd send federal marshals up here to shut down all our nanomachines." Doug still looked strangely unperturbed.
"Suppose we start up a new corporation," he suggested, "in Kiribati, and Masterson sells the Moonbase operation to them."
Greg's somber face paled.
"Sell Moonbase to them?"
Doug was grinning now.
"Sure. Moonbase and all our Earth orbital stations.
All the corporations' space operations."
"That could work," said Joanna.
It's an obvious attempt to circumvent the treaty, said Greg.
But it's legal, Doug replied. I checked it out with both the federal and international law programs.
Did you? Greg grumbled.
Joanna smiled a little.
Rashid won't like living in Tarawa, though.
Doug replied, he can stay in Savannah and be in Tarawa with a virtual reality connection anytime he wants to. Just the same as you attend board meetings without leaving here, Mom.
Greg objected. The board of directors would never go for it.
Setting up a dummy corporation and selling the space division to it, Joanna mused. It would take some explaining.
It'll never work, said Greg.
Why not? Doug challenged. You spent all those years out there in Kiribati. Don't you think you can get them to play along with us?
Of course I could, but...
Joanna interrupted with newfound enthusiasm. I'll call Carlos right away.
Why not the board chairman? Doug asked. Greg answered sourly, because Quintana is the real power on the board, present company accepted, of course.
Of course, Joanna agreed. Can you put the call through for me, please?
Frowning slightly, Greg touched the keyboard built into his desk with one long, slim finger and said merely, Carlos Quintana. The comm system's voice recognition circuitry searched automatically for Quintana's number and made the connection.
Johansson is just a figurehead, Joanna was explaining to Doug as the communications computer established the link with Savannah. He looks good for public relations, but he's...
The wall screen showing Monet lily pads changed abruptly to display a harried-looking young woman brushing at her disheveled hair.
I want to talk to Carlos, Joanna snapped, unaccustomed to having underlings answer her calls. He's dead, the young woman bawled, bursting into tears. He's been shot!
Joanna fell back against her chair's webbing, feeling almost as if a bullet had hit her heart. Ibrahim al-Rashid felt perspiration beading his brow and upper lip, despite the nearly frigid air conditioning of the small control room. Beyond that window, he knew, inside that gleaming metal sphere was a small man-made star, so hot and dense that its very atomic nuclei were being fused together. The plasma physicist tapped him on the shoulder and pointed to the power gauges lining the control room's side wall. Rashid nodded, too awed to speak. The control room was almost silent, nothing but the faint electrical hum from the monitoring consoles.
How long has it been running? Rashid asked in a whisper.
It seemed the proper tone of voice, this close to a miracle.
Tomorrow will make 4 months exactly, said the plasma physicist. Even he kept his voice hushed. He was a fellow Muslim, even a fellow native of Baltimore, a man Rashid had known in his youth. Now he was a paunchy, overweight academic with thinning hair and a light brown beard and eyes that blinked behind oversized, tinted glasses. Now he was a plasma physicist at Johns Hopkins University who just happened to have invented the world's first practical nuclear fusion generator.
And it has been producing power like this for all that time, Rashid whispered. The plasma physicist nodded.
As long as we keep it supplied with helium-3.
Rashid stroked his beard and turned back to stare through the safety glass of the small metal sphere. It was almost hidden inside a maze of magnet coils and cooling pipes and heavy tangles of multicolored electrical wires. In his imagination, Rashid could see inside the sphere, see the blinding hot plasma that was fusing atomic nuclei together, forcing mass to transmute into energy, imitating the processes that made the stars shine. By the Prophet, Rashid thought, Allah is offering us a gift beyond price, but not beyond cost. The plasma physicist gestured toward the door, and once out in the laboratory's hallway again, Rashid drew a deep breath. It really works, he said, almost in a normal tone.
It really works, the plasma physicist echoed, and much better and cheaper than that monstrosity up in Princeton.
But it requires helium-3 for fuel, which the Princeton machine does not.
The Princeton machine is designed to produce new PhDs, the plasma physicist grumbled. My generator is designed to produce megawatts.
The plasma physicist led him up the hallway toward his own cluttered office.
Helium-3 and deuterium, he said. The deuterium is easy to get from ordinary water. There's enough deuterium in an 8-ounce drinking glass of water to equal the energy in 500,000 barrels of oil.
Rashid smiled wanly.